Good evening, and welcome to tonight's book reading by Barbara Walker and Poetic Addendums by Jim and Jim Jr. And there is none better to tell this story than Barbara, who owns a PhD in psychology from UO and devoted a professional career in counseling. She's written two children's books and a memoir about growing up in Maine. Having read this book twice, I can tell you, you don't have to read in between the lines to grasp this mother's pain. The tenacity of her words shout, and here are the Walkers.
Well, thank you all for coming. This is very flattering. Thank you. We'll begin with the dedication. This project is dedicated to the curiosity that led us to know, respect, and love each other as a mother and son in ways we hadn't anticipated.
Also, to the parents and children whose lives have been complicated by a child's birth defect or disability.
And to the care providers who took the time to notice and help parents and children cope with the stress of hospitalizations and painful procedures.
So I want to add my, I'm Jimmy. So I want to add my thanks to this turnout and to this crowd and for welcoming my parents in the Cascade Manor. That touches me in a lot of ways that we won't get into tonight. So we're going to be reading excerpts from this book that follow the main sections of it, which are chronologically organized. Not only in, kind of in our lives, but as you'll hear, I think, in our process of having kind of learned about each other and learned about the process of writing and creating. So this really, it all started with just a simple conversation, and this is in the prologue from a chapter called The Invitation. We're going to start with that.
You know, Mom, Jim said through the narrow slit between his jaws, I never thought about it before. But what was it like for you being my mother? It must have been hard on you, too. The comet bowled me over. It was November 2014. My son Jim was 44 years old. He was recovering from a complex cleft palate surgery, one of the many surgeries to correct complications from a birth defect, a severe bilateral cleft palate and lip. His jaws had been wired shut since the surgery 10 days ago. On this evening, Jim and I found ourselves relaxing together in his kitchen. I'd been sipping a glass of white wine, and he'd just finished sucking down a berry smoothie through a straw wedged in the slit between his wired jaws. That's when he shot me the question, what was it like for you being my mother? It was as though Jim had handed me a hot wire. I startled, nearly spilling my wine. My first impulse was to give a succinct synopsis, all tidied up for easy consumption. In my head, alarms sounded, but from deep inside, a steady voice urged me to risk it all, to hold the hot wire and make the connection Jim was offering. I was aware that my eyes had flooded, and the words I wanted to say stuck in my throat. Jim leaned forward, his brow furrowed, and he put a hand on my arm. A month later, Jim's father and I were spending the Christmas holiday with Jim and his family. The house was full of Christmas spirit. On Christmas morning, Jim donned a Santa hat and passed presents to everyone amid oohs and ahs and thank yous. Just as the gift opening was ending, Jim plucked a small green envelope from its hiding place in the Christmas tree's branches, and with a solemnity that seemed out of keeping with the moment, he handed it to me. This is for you, Mom, he said, from me. I looked at him quizzically, but his expression told me nothing. I opened the cheerful red and white striped card and read,
Mom, your gift is one we have to share. I've signed us up for a memoir writing workshop starting in January. And we'll meet with the coordinator this Saturday morning. Here's to sharing our shared memories. Love, Jimmy.
So, roll back the clock now to 1970. June 25, 1970, 1 a.m. It's a boy, the doctor announces in a steady voice. The baby wails, but everyone else in the room is strangely quiet. James, this is James in this story because too many Jims is confusing to readers, so he'll be James. James, who has been observing the delivery, moves to my head and strokes my forehead. Quiet. I grin at him, but am puzzled by his solemn gaze. I imagine he is touched beyond words by witnessing the birth of his son, our first baby. May I see the baby? I ask politely, though I'm irritated at the delay. We're taking him to the nursery to clean him up first. The doctor's voice comes from beyond my feet, beyond my field of vision. I hear a swinging door open and shut, telling me that someone has exited with my baby. James follows in the direction of the door. There is hushed movement in the room. One of the nurses busies herself at a prep table nearby. Please roll on your side so we can give you your shot. I oblige. But then I ask, what's the shot for? To dry up your milk, dear. But I'm planning to nurse, I sputter, feeling helpless. Silence. It's okay. Soft words from the doctor. I feel reassured. Then a sharp pain in my right buttock as a needle delivers the medication. The nurse offers a couple of pills, which I take, trusting the care I'm receiving. A short time later, I lie alone in a room painted in a dull shade of salmon pink. I note the reproduction of Van Gogh's sunflowers on the wall beyond my feet. I wait and wait and wait. I tell myself to be patient. Eventually, the doctor enters the room, still in scrubs. His expression is serious. He pulls up a chair and leans in. He takes a deep breath before speaking. We've checked the baby thoroughly. His internal organs are intact, and his vision, hearing, and mental functioning seem normal. Great, I say, wondering if all new mothers hear this report. We do have a problem, however. By now, I'm adrift in a haze, induced, I learn later, by the sedative administered in the delivery room. Your baby was born with a cleft palate. It's a physical deformity that can be fixed. He's a little jaundiced as well, and we're monitoring his bilirubin level. Otherwise, he's a healthy baby. From a distant place, I watch myself return the doctor's steady gaze. I nod and manage a thin smile. The doctor must be relieved that my face remains expressionless. I am not going to go hysterical in him.
Well, I, of course, very much anticipated the birth of our first child. And, of course, I had my own reactions to Jim's birth. On the first day of my medical internship, on June 24th, during Barbara's labor, I ran back and forth through the long and dimly lit underground tunnels that connected the medical and the obstetrical hospital buildings at Case Western Reserve. Shortly before I was paged for Barbara's delivery, I had just admitted the first patient of my official medical career, a middle-aged woman with a severe kidney infection. I arrived in the obstetrical suite in time for Barbara's final contractions, and I can only recount a jumble of sights, sounds, emotions, and poorly organized thoughts over the next few minutes. The bustle and noise of the medical staff in preparation, Barbara's tenacity and uncomplaining efforts, elation with the delivery and forceful cry of our new little baby, it's a boy. Next, a stunned brief silence, the obstetrician whispering to me and showing me Jimmy's cleft lip, then my wordlessly touching Barbara's forehead before being ushered from the room by the obstetrician, who reassured me that our son was probably healthy and had a surgically correctable congenital anomaly. During these few minutes, I was bewildered. I had had no experience in my medical education with anything related to craniofacial birth disorders. Our baby was whisked away to wherever newborns go. I was whisked away, and my aunt, who was there, and the doctor instructed me on what to tell Barbara, who by now was well sedated and would soon be whisked away to bed. When I have revisited these numbing moments, I'm reminded of how little I had to offer her. Around 2:30 in the morning, I returned to the medical ward through the tunnels. I recall then that the numbness gave over to tears, and I choked back sobs before I was able to redirect my thoughts to my patient and the intern responsibilities back on the wards. At that point in time, the three most important people in my life were Barbara, my son, and my first patient. In 1970, the hospital system associated with Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine was probably as well equipped as any in the country at that time to deal with newborn craniofacial disorders. But it wasn't until the mid-1980s that most hospitals used prenatal ultrasonography to detect presence of a cleft lip, and much later that craniofacial teams were established to support parents before and after the birth of a child with a cleft palate. This is not to say that Barbara and I felt deprived of good medical services in June of 1970, but the historical perspective of the evolution of the standard of care may deepen understanding of what Barbara, Jiminy, and I were confronted with at that earlier time. During the first 3 years of Jimmy's life, Barbara found herself in an environment that also demanded hard work and commitment to perform in a role for which she had no training or role models and no system to support her. She had to find her way and create her own rewards. When she brought Jimmy home 24 days after his birth, she left behind the hospital environment that had provided professional care for Jimmy as a patient, if not for her. But that system did not support or prepare us for what lay outside the hospital walls.
So that's the first section of the book is really the birth and the very first formative years, which I don't have a lot of direct memories of. So as I tried. The second section really starts to include some of my earliest impressions and trying to convert those into memories. So this is called Memory Study 1. You look stupid. Hair lip dumbass. Quickly you learn there aren't that many teasing words, but each one, each time, leaves a little mark, a little memory. Year to year, only a few kids ever do the teasing, and a few more just watch, and all the rest just look away. What? You sound stupid. No one can understand you. Even the sound of my own voice in my own head flows thick. I try to avoid talking, try to avoid being present, try to avoid anything causing me to be noticed, because then the cleft will be noticed, and then I'll be the center of attention. The exclusion. The pattern of exclusion. Children ruthlessly choose those most like them, leaving out others for the slightest detail of difference. Any common mistake, a missed kickball, a stammer in class, is connected to the cleft, so I'm easier to pick out next time. You look retarded. Retard? Stop looking at me. I imagine something deeper within me must also be different. Though I sense no one is actually normal, I don't yet really believe that. And I can't stop sulking on the words of these others. The possibilities in the words are as real as the heat of the sun. The targeting, despite trying to be unseen. I see that other kids' details, their faces, clothes, darker skin, cause them greater torment than mine. Yet the weight that is mine has my full attention. What happened to your face? You look stupid. Stop looking at me. I learn to be unlooked at, unseen, unheard, to be but without presence. I learn to accept the separation as just living, easier on everyone this way. And then, and so as we then got into a little bit deeper into elementary school, early middle school, we weren't communicating. We both were having thoughts and feelings about our difficult experiences intertwined. And we had our own kind of questions that were in search of answers. And so we have a few sections on that.
The big question. I've asked myself the question a million times, and now it comes at me like a slap in the face from my 14-year-old Jim. What did you do to cause this, Mom? He points to his upper lip, marked by scars from 5 surgeries, 3 to close the bilateral clefts and 2 to repair scars. You must have done something. This doesn't just happen to someone. His look, half accusatory, half pleading, stops me in my tracks. I catch my breath. The question is huge, and I pray I don't mangle the answer. What makes you ask? I resist defending myself or admitting guilt and stay with his questions. In biology class, we're learning about how babies of drug users often have birth defects. Did you use drugs, Mom? A strange calm comes over me as I feel Jim's sharp, line-drive question. I call up with surprising confidence the mother part of me that has come to terms with the probability of the cause. My voice is steady and sure. If you're talking about drugs like pot, cocaine, or heroin, I did not. His piercing look holds me in place. But I did use aspirin and cold medicines. He waits. Jim, I've been asking myself this question since the day you were born. I've asked doctors, read books, and depending on the expert, the answer changes. 1 year it's caffeine, then it's alcohol, then it's drugs. And yes, I did drink a lot of coffee and a glass of wine now and then. And even though there have been no instances of cleft palate in our families that anyone can remember for sure, my best guess is that it's a problem with my genes. So that's the best answer I can give you. My genes are most likely responsible for your cleft problems. I look straight at him, and I'm more sorry than I can say. Our eyes lock. I want what I say next to hit with full force. But you need to know something more. You were a planned for and wanted child. Your dad and I love you very much, and I wouldn't trade you for the world. We stay that way for a long moment, and then Jim quietly leaves the room. James, who has been sitting frozen on the sofa, comes to life. Honey, that must have been devastating. No, I say it wasn't. I feel a sudden lightness, an unburdening. I didn't realize until this moment that I'd been waiting for this question for years. It's a relief to answer it. At least now, Jim will not blame himself for being born with a cleft. I don't mind that he blamed me, better me than himself. I may never discover a better answer. But this one brings a peace of mind I've not felt before.
This is called To Questions Without Answers. You draw us forward, teasing what we understand, smirking as we only find more questions. You don't resist our guesses, our science, the writings we pass around, to keep from falling down so deep in the myths we need for why hard things happen. Why a cleft on this child? Why this life for this mother? Yet you never reveal resolution. You enable us to conceive of a God both deliberate and mocking. You allow us to imagine that sway over our circumstances might just be one more revelation ahead. And so we dream of catching you that we might breathe again and move on, all of us together. Yet there you go, still smirking, singing, it could be this, it could be that. It all could be for no reason at all, at all. There could be no reason at all. And then this is called Perhaps I Have a Cleft Because. I am the blessed, the chosen one, as in ancient times. My mother drank just a bit too much during pregnancy. I am cursed for the sins of forgotten ancestors. My mother smoked just a bit too much. I did a terrible thing in a past life. My mother ate too much spicy food. My parents' lives were easy, so they had this coming. My mother exercised too much or too little. A couple links of genetic code did what they were supposed to do. God hates me. A couple links of genetic code awoke from a long slumber. God hates my mother. A couple links of genetic code unlinked. God knew I wouldn't be a big believer, and so he clefted me early. I needed an excuse to push back on the world. God was preparing my path. I needed a challenge, a reason, a foundation. God doesn't exist. All of the above, in some way. None of the above, but something else. In the dimming of the evening in my bedroom as a teen, as the world slowed to shadow and all things found their quiet, my tongue traced the smooth cleft in the dark of the roof of my mouth, and I began settling into acceptance of my mysteries. So, as we were kind of dancing around each other and having these moments of our questions and answers that centered around the cleft, there was a lot of our experiences that were really fairly, I think, common for parent and child and teenager. Every teenager wrestles with something, right? I mean, I think we all know that. And I had one particular experience that we both write about here when I was 16. So I'm going to read some excerpts from that. It's kind of a longer one, and I'm reading a couple parts of that. This is called Phone Calls from a Bike Trip. One of my mother's fondest fear-filled memories is my solo bike trip from Vancouver, Canada to Eugene in the mid-80s. She's resistant, but has been trying to let go of me for years. I'm young and privileged, yet coming-of-age stories need some sharp edge to be of any use. Her final insistence is that I call her from wherever I end the day, every day. On a stretch of campground in the San Juan Islands, I leave my YMCA group for a ferry to Vancouver to visit the World's Fair and then meet a girl. Her parents forget I'm coming. So does the girl. I'm locked out of their house, my first night's shelter. I call my mother from their neighbor's house. She's horrified, then thankful. I realize this will be a long trip for her. On a stretch of already narrow back lane near Oak Harbor, I'm almost run off the road by a pickup blaring a horn, and I'm struck by my distance from anything familiar. I curse the driver. Later, as I'm setting up camp in a dark side yard, I'm taken in by the hospitality of strangers. They say blessings for me as we all hold hands. I'm living in a parable. I call my mother from their kitchen phone. Again, she's horrified, then thankful. I've invented a new style of mother torture. On a stretch of impossibly straight road off the Oregon coast, bounded at each far end by coast wooded hills, I'm set to resume another after another flat tire and realize a silence has settled in, a wide stillness. No cars or RVs approach from either direction. No engine echo or bird call hangs in the air. Even the wind is holding its breath, which never happens here. I wait for something. It seems I need to wait. It seems this place has been waiting for me. The blue of the sky and the heat of the sun are the purest of themselves I've ever known. The moment stretches open and invites me to stay. I do not remember how I leave. I tell my mother about the black bears at the campground instead. I still have the photo of me burned tanned and smiling with the blue bike fully geared in front of my parents' house. My stance says I'm already looking forward to catching up with my yet young forever friends. My mother insists something has changed about me. Perhaps she's looking at me from somewhere she's never stood before. Perhaps I'm standing there as if I've just arrived. I forget if I say anything to my mother in this moment.
So, of course, during all this time, Jim still needed to have care for his cleft palate. And this next excerpt is about a debrief after a two-day evaluation at a cleft palate clinic in a university hospital in Portland. And this is the debrief after all of the evaluations. A social worker convened the meeting. She announced that the case that day involved a 10-year-old boy with a cleft palate. No name, just the case. Before turning the meeting over to the medical team, she said in a cautionary tone, "The mother's in the room." Apparently, my name wasn't Jermaine either. She pointed to where I was seated against the wall. Heads turned. I smiled and waved, hoping to convey friendly intentions. At one point, an oral surgeon took the floor and reported with enthusiasm the paper he had recently given at a medical conference on implanted teeth. At the time, transplanting teeth was a new procedure, still in an experimental phase. "It's similar to transplanting a potted plant," he opined. Furthermore, he thought, it would be a good idea for this case, given the number of missing teeth. I raised my hand. "I have a question." Heads turned in my direction. Eyebrows shot up. "The mother has a question? How many of these teeth implants have you performed in this medical center?" The oral surgeon shuffled his papers. Only one to date. "And what do you estimate to be the rejection rate?" He hesitated and then replied quietly, "About 50%. "Well, then I don't think we're interested in this for Jimmy at this time. We'll wait until the procedure has been perfected." There was an awkward silence and a few mutterings around the table before someone brought the meeting back to order. A few years later, Jim was around 17, and we again visited the craniofacial clinic in Portland. This time, there was a craniofacial reconstructive surgeon visiting to consult on Jimmy's case. "I do my best to hold my own against the not-so-subtle efforts to keep me on the perimeter of this discussion. No one addresses me or Jim by name or inquires about our concerns. I can handle it, but I wonder if Jim will fare well face-to-face in this face-to-face encounter with the aloof consultant from L.A. I've seen his spirits nosedive when doctors treat him as just another item on their docket. Often he simply closes his eyes and withdraws. As I watch, fearing the worst, the consultant bends over for a closer look and extends his gloved, skilled surgeon's fingers toward Jim's mouth. Jim extends his right hand toward the surgeon. "Hello," he says. His tone of voice is as firm as the consultant's. "My name's Jim Walker. What's yours?"
There were a lot of surgeries, you know, and I had not as many as some, you know, more than others. This one is about in 2014 was the last round, and that kind of precipitated this whole project. So this is called LaFort, whereby the jaw is cut from the skull along a natural fracture pattern discovered in 1901, allowing the relocation of the jaw in three dimensions, with options if grafting is considered viable. Such surgeries are now common for correcting mid-face deformities with reliable long-term results. I am hopeful for long-term results. I am choosing to be reshaped one more time. They say recovery is 6 weeks at best, with your jaw wired shut, liquid diet, resting to allow the packed-in bone to settle, to round off so your face appears more natural. They say some people won't recognize you. They remind you that you chose this once again. My lover does not care much about any of this. She loves me because I am more than this. She walks ahead, beside, behind as she senses. She is yet new to me, her reactions yet new to my son, my parents, to all who know me, yet she stands at the center. She makes a 6 week supply of soup and smoothies with my mother. She collects my hopes of a day my face might be finished, saying in my ear, "Baby, if this is what you want, then I want it too. I'm here. I'm in this for the long haul."
At an earlier time, with time, there were adjustments in my parenting role. This is from a chapter entitled Obligations. Barbara's professional pursuit took a new path when she began to discuss how her personal activism, in Jimmy's case, might evolve into a career. I applauded her taking this step. Her enrollment in graduate school meant that I had to assume more responsibility at home. Besides doing more laundry, washing dishes, I did the grocery shopping on my day off. I made arrangements with my partners to be free by 6:30 every Wednesday evening for several semesters to be with the boys so Barbara could attend her required classes. It was an adjustment for both of us. My free time was reduced, and Barbara felt guilty about spending less time at home, especially when the boys occasionally gave me a hard time. Eventually, we hit a comfortable stride, and I discovered a benefit I had not expected. As my time with the boys increased, they sought me out more often, and I experienced fathering in a way I had not enjoyed before. This development created more balance in our parenting roles, and I enjoyed increased time with my boys.
So, as this whole project went on, it took a few years. All of them lovely.
Yeah. Of course.
And as it kind of matured into actually thinking it could be a project that could be a book, then it influenced some of the later things. So this is one towards the back, towards the end here. I'm only going to read the first few stanzas of this. She's called Letter to a Clefted Child. None of the circumstances of your birth were ever in your control. From your first moment, you have been all you needed, ever. But I know, I remember, the moments my path was hard and I was alone and I could not see how the future would ever be brighter. You will settle into a relationship with your cleft, as with your name. At times you will try to disown it, or find only harsh comfort in it, or surrender to how it presents you to the outside world. And the world will always and relentlessly respond. Your family, perhaps even your mother, will do their best to understand what you are experiencing and to help. But only your emerging opinion of the rumbled roof of your mouth matters, even though their efforts are earnest and grounded in their love of choosing you. Goes on for a bit, but I'm just going to leave it there.
It's a wonderful poem. You should buy the book and read the whole thing. And finally, what has come of our decision as a mother and adult son to reveal to one another our personal and shared experiences, many of which were hard to talk about? This chapter is called Finding Words. Only Jim can speak to the truths of his experience as a child weathering years of cleft palate repairs. Only he can say how our times together as mother and child shaped his becoming the person he is today. Only I can say how the challenges I faced alone and those we faced together altered the course of my life. And now we have found our voices and the words to speak those truths to one another. When Jim invited me to write our story, I was initially at a loss for words and reluctant to disclose what mothering him had been like for me. Did I want to admit failures, lay myself open to criticisms, legitimate or otherwise, of my parenting, expose myself to lingering anger or disappointment? Could I be honest about my sadness when he had pushed me away and resisted my efforts to comfort him? Could I tell him I wished we'd been closer, communicated better? I feared that writing honestly about our personal struggles would open old wounds and for each of us. Would honest talk close or deepen those wounds? Could we find words to reveal hidden personal truths in ways that would bring us closer, or would we fail and grow more distant? I expressed these concerns to Jim. After all, wasn't our relationship relatively stable? I did not want to risk what we had. He assured me he could hear anything I divulged. And finally, from a chapter called Beyond Words, as I recognized the value of my conversations with Jim, I began to engage Kent, his brother, in similar conversations, inviting him to ask questions about his life in our family and to answer mine. These endeavors to have candid conversations with my adult children have yielded relationship rewards beyond expectation for parents and adult children who are ready to share memories in order to settle unresolved issues from the past or simply deepen their relationship. These conversations, risky though they may seem, are well worth undertaking. And that concludes our reading. So, as you know, we've allowed some time for comments or questions, and please direct your questions to either anyone you want.
Thank you very much. I have a question to all of you or any of you. You didn't mention any if Jimmy, I'll call him Jimmy, because he's always Jim to me, has siblings, and how many, and how was the effect of the cleft palate on them, and how did they deal with it?
Well, there is a section in the book about family life at the birth of our second son, Kent, 3 years later. And, of course, I was very concerned during that pregnancy, and I insisted, actually, that we stay at University Hospitals in Rochester while Jim go on to the service. But as it turned out, we all could wait. Kit was born without any anomalies, except later he did have an anomaly in the roof of his mouth, which I took as a warning sign, and that was the end of having children for me. I didn't want to test it again. So he would say, because I asked him, if he felt any special effect from being Jim's brother. Of course, he was bossed around a lot by Jim, right?
Yeah, I remember throwing him through a bay window once.
Yeah. That's one of Ken's fondest memories, because he got to go to the ER and have stitches in his foot. But Ken said he was surprised I asked him. He felt he got enough attention, because this is often the concern, because a lot of the parental concern is taken up with the child who needs attention more for obvious reasons. He said, you know, I never thought about it. He said, you know, I really didn't, Mom. And then he said, actually, later when I was a teenager, I liked it that you were preoccupied with Jimmy so much.
Little additional story about Kent. So Jimmy was born in Cleveland, but when Kent was born, we had moved to Rochester, New York, to extend my medical training, and that's where Kent was born. And we, you know, I had a little more time on my hands, so I was a little more involved initially during the Barb's labor. And when the labor nurse came in and introduced herself, we realized with some horror this was the same nurse who presided over the labor at Case Western Reserve Hospital
in Cleveland.
Cleveland, when Jimmy was born. We thought, oh my God, where is God now? After, when Kent was born, we learned right away, of course, that he did not have a cleft palate and cleft lip, and we were very elated. There still was no prenatal ultrasonography at that time. And a few hours later, when the pediatrician came back in the room and said, well, we have a problem, it was like all over again. The problem, however, was ABO incompatibility. So Kent's blood cells were breaking down because of some transfer of antibody over the placenta into his bloodstream. The bilirubin, which is the result of this incompatibility, was going up at a rate that suggested if nothing were done, he might develop significant brain damage from that. And the pediatrician said, well, this is what the trend is appearing, but we can take care of this. All we have to do is give him a complete blood transfusion. And because he had not had the cleft palate, we said, oh, my God, that's fine. Just go ahead and do that. That's great. No problem. Small world.
Betsy?
Well, I've had the pleasure of almost finishing the book. I have 40 pages still to go. And I want to reassure everybody in this auditorium that they need to buy it and read it.
Oh, I pay her.
And Jim, your poetry is exquisite. But the writing is so compelling. And I can't remember the last time I read a paper book. I read on Kindle almost exclusively. But this is going to a lot of people for Christmas. It's incredible.
Thank you. Wow.
The front row is killing it here.
It took a lot of courage for you all to write this book. And I wonder how it's changed your relationship as a family to put it all out there in what I understand is one of Amazon's best-selling books.
Well, me. Well, in our own minds.
Another Barbara put out a memoir this week, too, which knocked us off. I think, though, that one of the... So 9 years ago, right, is when this kind of started, and this isn't what we imagined at the beginning. And that, if we had imagined this kind of outcome at the beginning, it may not have, that might have been too much weight. So I think just the thought and the baby steps of kind of, well, do you remember this? And how do you remember that? How much weight was that for you? How did you, and there's a lot of things that, you know, we don't, a very strong memory for me is not one for her and vice versa, which when you think about it, say that makes sense, but until you actually talk to your parent or talk to your child, it's not there. So I think it inevitably dissolves lingering emotion, if there is some, that could be decades old, and then you discover stuff. So, and that's one of these core themes that has nothing to do with my cleft, that I think was also something we discovered along the way.
I will point out that this didn't start out to be a book. It started out to be a sharing through writing. And I will say that I think it's easier to be honest and candid in writing. You get a chance to think it through and maybe revise and change. But I made a commitment, and I told him I'm going to be very honest, and it might not be pretty. And I'm not sure a mother should be telling a child some of this. But he said he could handle it. And I will say that as we went along, I was in a writing group. Two of the members are here tonight, Quentin and Evelyn back there, and they began to encourage me to think of it as a book. So then we started organizing it chronologically. We started out with just memories of events, you know, not chronologically, or do you remember when this happened? And we each have events that are kind of seared in our memories that were, you know, impactful, and some of them for me were pivotal. Some of the encouraging ones were especially pivotal when a teacher or a coach who was sitting here in the front row takes an interest in your child and sees promise in your child and mentors your child. Those things give you great heart, and then you can do a lot of other things. And I will also say this, that I would not have undertaken this probably if Jim hadn't invited me. I can't imagine inviting him. You know, I think he might have said, oh, Mom. But, you know, he was the one who was in the mood to write this story and ask the question. And I do think you have to undertake this with a commitment to be non-judgmental, non-defensive. When a child asks you, why did you do this? Why did you and Dad move so often? That was so hard on me. It deserves an answer. And we have an answer, but not to get defensive. Well, you don't understand. We were doing in training. But just to answer, there were reasons with it, and vice versa.
When you're talking about the transition from a personal project to something that you're going to throw out there with some expose, you might say something about the experience you had in Seattle that I think helped convince you that this might be something worth pursuing.
Oh, well, so for some reason I submitted our manuscript to a writing competition at the Pacific Northwest Writers Association in the fall of 2021, and we were finalists in the nonfiction category. So, ooh, that was good. So we all three went to Seattle, and we had to sort of pitch the book to a couple of agents. That was a sobering experience. It deserves a whole nother evening. But we realized as we were talking that when you have to give an elevator speech for why you think this book matters, the biggest thing we came up with was how much it deepened our relationship in ways we would never have achieved otherwise, and we didn't start out for that reason. We just decided we wanted to be honest. And so that was the thing that evolved over the telling. We heard each other's writings, and they touched us. And some of this book, which you couldn't appreciate too much tonight, is almost a call and response. His bike trip, I wrote about first, about the solo bike trip and the difficulty I had with his wanting to do this, while he was doing this, and my recognition of how much it meant for him to do it. So that his response is the postcard poem. So, but I want to say there was one, it happened that Jim was bringing his son, Jim, up to an outdoor experience somewhere north of Bend one summer while we were writing this. And I said, well, why don't you come a day early and we'll spend a day up on the Mackenzie River. We had we were staying in a place for the weekend. And so he came, and we went to this wonderful place, looked out at the river. Before he came, I sent him 30 questions I wanted answers to, and he sent me 30 questions. We took our food and our preferred libations, and we sat for 5 hours and asked each other lots of questions that we had never asked each other before. And I tell you, the world was on our side because the birds came in. We saw osprey catch a fish. Some Canada geese came swooping through and then landed in front of us. And a flock of, were they cinnamon ducks or something, were hanging out there. It was just magical, but it was a wonderful experience which came about because we'd undertaken this project. You want to add to that?
I think that's, does that answer your question?
Say something nice. Say something nice.
No, we... No, it absolutely deepened our relationship, I think, in all the ways that you heard there, and in unexpected ways. So it was very, very good. Yeah.
This is a question for Jimmy. The poetry that you've written, was that written chronologically over a long period of time, or has it been since you've been an adult and started the project?
So part of what my mother mentioned was that this it started as like sharing writings, like we'll write something, which is a easier entry than the StoryCorps approach, where you sit down across from each other and write, just talk. But I studied poetry in college, so I had found early on that was an expression that came easy. Right, every one of us has a form of expression that comes easier than the others, and you just got to lean into that. I had not been doing as much writing as I had wanted as I got older. So, but it was still, and my mother's written other books, other nonfiction materials, so I knew that was an easy style for her. So I had been writing, but having the exercise of the call and response and the opportunity certainly was nice to get
back. But these are all written during this 9-year period.
None of these predate this project. Yeah.
I have a comment and then a question. Please don't let me forget to ask the question at the end.
It depends on how long your comment is.
I know, that's what, that's worrying me, actually. My daughter accuses me of using the longest preambles in history. Anyway, I'm a recovering developmental biologist from... I did my research starting at Case Western Reserve, leaving Case Western Reserve in 1970, so I never had the opportunity to meet that young man while he was working there. For some reason, I had the opportunity to do research on craniofacial development. And I just want to say that if you haven't looked at the embryology of the process of the closing of the cleft of the wings of the palate, it's a truly miraculous thing. And I don't know how to express it. It's so miraculous and so sort of, the timing of everything that has to go on. It's a miracle that it doesn't go bad more often. And that's just as an avid professional, but not a physician. And I'd like to say one more thing. I'd like to say something about physicians who have to deal with this stuff. They, I believe, soon, maybe James can comment about this. they seem to be able to put a shell around themselves to make them seem sort of tough and unemotional about it. But that's sort of required, I believe, in order to allow them to do their job. No, you don't like it. I get it. I wonder if whether in medical training these days there's an opportunity for physicians to learn how to deal with these things in a humane and straightforward way without protecting themselves so much.
And is that the question?
That's not the question. but that's, man, we were so, but I, we were so I, close. I bring that up just because it's an issue I know that my physician friends deal with.
Well, in my short answer, and I want to watch the clock too, because I know the timing Thank matters you. Here. Yeah. But I think in particular, different fields of practice maybe require a shell more than some others. I think if you're a nephrologist and dealing with people and I think you need to have some empathy. There needs to be a connection point. Surgeons are the ones I would call out that need to do a better job on that shell. And I understand, I imagine that playing God like that as a surgeon is you need to have a shell of some kind. Yes. But to not manage the expectations and the communication with the people and the extended family of those people, there's no reason that should not still be where it is 50 years after some of our experiences. So, and one other thing I'll say is that we're still hearing that people, mothers and kids are having some of the same experiences with the medical system today, you know, that we were. There's a lot more support, myface.org. There's a lot more support out there, but there's still those interactions. So, but what's your question? Then I'll hand him the mic.
Okay. My
and then
question,
I'm going to cut you off.
Yes. First of all, I agree with what you said, and it's a hard problem to deal with. My question should be simple for you to answer. It's how did you choose to use the title "Choosing Ourselves"? What was your thinking in that?
There were a lot of different title options. We went around and around on that, and that's the one that, as it marinated the longest and felt the best. It wasn't like a flash, like that's it. It was a process.
I kind of like the double meaning of choosing ourselves. Choosing ourselves means being able to advocate for yourself and your needs. In situations where sometimes you're not encouraged to be a prominent voice, in choosing ourselves, not letting other people choose for us, is the other meaning that I like, and the publishers liked it. We thought they'd think of something more clever, but they didn't. You didn't have any problems. Oh, I didn't take that. I shouldn't take that.
Well, I just want to thank you for having so much courage, and I'm just sort of astonished by how you're able to hold it together while you're doing all this, because, you know, reading the book, I was very weepy. But, Jimmy, to you, the poem that you wrote to your younger self, I think that is so powerful, and I hope you expand on that in a book or some kind of form for kids.
So Letter to a Clefted Child, that kind of the capstone, the reflection back, certainly is to me and to some other kid. And I've tried to go to our local Operation Smile events, and I'm going to be real candid and loop back. The medical community kind of controls that, and so it's not a place where I could do that with some of the young kids. Yeah, no, but the kids need to know they have their others as well, you know, with whatever their issue is, right? And that's true for anything that would distinguish a kid among other kids. Not just a clef, of course, but you can't. But if I'm going to put on positions about managing expectations, I can't do that to a kid. But yeah, absolutely. No, that's crossed my mind, and that's an interesting thought to expand on that. Thank you.
Not to put James on the spot, but how did the Barbara and Jim's writing of the book affect you? I know that fathers in 1970 had jobs, and a career in medicine is very demanding. I can appreciate that some, because the career of a clergyman is too. The night we had 20 people coming for dinner and he never came. So how has this affected your relationship as a family, but watching Barbara and Jim get closer and closer, how has that affected you?
Well, I guess there are two parts to that question. Where was I at the beginning, and how did I feel about that? The second part of the question, I guess, is coming together. I think this was a wonderful collaborative project that I think, I won't speak for all parents, but I wish I could have had the same experience with either one of my boys, and being able to write about this and have this love experience. My experience with my parents was that I approached them with questions that one could say were somewhat similar too late in their lives. So I didn't have this experience, and I suspect many of us have had that happen as well. So I'm extremely respectful. I did not want to participate in this originally. This was their project. And it was only because there were people who read this early on, like you just suggested, and said, where was the father? So there had to be some voice there. And I was a father, not in absentia, but on the periphery. They stuck with me, and I stuck with them. and it's been a wonderful ride, and especially with experiences like seeing them come together, it was a wonderful project. I'm so proud of them.
I'll just say that he's always been in our corner in writing this book. And when we were in Seattle at that writer's conference, we had to give a 4-minute pitch. And that meant 2 minutes apiece to say something very, pithy. And he was our coach. We would read to him and he'd time us and but he was wonderful. He's been through it all the way.
And with that, it's 8
it's
o'clock.
It's a little after 8, so feel free to
one,
leave.
One more
or
question.
We can...
Well, I simply want to say thank you. And Jim, when you were reading your poetry, I sensed something extremely special within you in being able to create what it was you were reading. And your voice doubled the impact of that. I just want to say I hope you continue to write poetry, and hope, especially maybe for children, that you'll be able to read it, or at least they'll be able to hear your voice. Very special. Thank you.
Well, that's a way to thank you for that. No, that's, this is my work path and career path has taken me away from that. So this has been a nice exercise to get back into the actual writing, and reading's another dimension of it. A lot of people write and very few people read out loud. So thank you for that.
I will tell you that when we were pitching this book, we were told by many people it would never sell because you can't combine narrative and poetry. People read either one or the other, not both. They'll buy a book for one or the other, but they won't buy a book with both. But we found a publisher who thought it made it a little unique.
Prove them wrong.
What can you do?
So now,
buy books and you can write a positive review on Amazon. That's where...
So the book's available online at several different outlets, including Amazon. And if you have an alternative favorite, that's probably there too. Tsunami Books will have it in store.
And Jay Michaels has it. Will have it.
And the people in 4113 might have a few copies.
Maybe a few.
All right, thank you all for coming.